Welcome to the Insurance AUM Journal podcast. My name is Stuart Foley, and I'm your host, standing with you at the corner of insurance and asset management. We're very fortunate to be joined by a very well-known retail analyst from Loop Capital, Anthony Chikumba. Anthony, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Stuart. And before we get started, I'd just like to say I am losing my podcast virginity here today. So please, please be gentle with me.
That's hilarious. We're really lucky because it just turns out that on top of being a very well-regarded and well-known retail analyst, Anthony also happens to be my neighbor. And so we are sheltering in place, maintaining an appropriate amount of social distance. And we were talking about the retail sector in this COVID crisis. And so Anthony had a lot of interesting things to share. He's got a very rich background in this particular area. And we were kicking around the idea of, hey, why don't we do a podcast? He knew we did them. And so here we are. So Anthony, I think probably be helpful if everybody kind of had a better understanding of your background.
Sure, absolutely. So I was an accounting major undergraduate. I first became interested in Wall Street, funny enough, after seeing a few movies, specifically Wall Street, the classic with Michael Douglas and Charlie Sheen, and then a lesser known but classic movie called Working Girl, which was with Melanie Griffith and Harrison Ford. Very underrated. I would definitely check it out. So that's how I first got interested in investment banking. After undergraduate, I started in the mergers and acquisitions department at Merrill Lynch. Did that for a couple of years. Then I went to business school. And then I came back to Wall Street working in corporate finance, but specifically working with retailers and apparel manufacturers. So doing things like raising capital, doing M&A, but all for retailers and apparel manufacturers. So that was my first foray into the retail business. Now, at that time, investment bankers and research analysts worked very, very closely together, quite frankly, too closely, but that's another conversation for another podcast. And it was my first exposure to the equity research function. And I definitely remember thinking to myself, you know what, that seems a lot more interesting and intellectually challenging than what I do. And I also thought to myself, you know, I think I can do that job. So I eventually ended up leaving Wall Street. I worked for Sears. I moved from the New York area to Chicago, and I worked as a business finance manager, kind of like a junior CFO, working with a few different departments there. I then finally got my opportunity to work in equity research. I worked first with Morningstar, the firm that's best known for their bond ratings, mutual fund ratings, but they eventually got into the equity research business. And then I sort of parlayed that into what I do now, where I'm an institutional equity research analyst, a sell-side institutional equity research analyst. So I've been in the retail industry for over 20 years at this point, which is almost scary to say. I've been covering retail as an equity research analyst for over 15 years.
Those of you who are listening to this podcast can't see Anthony, but by looking at you, you don't look like it's possible that you've been at it this long. You know, you've done CNBC, you've done Bloomberg, you've been all over the place. So obviously, we're very happy to have you here. You know, it's not like it was a cakewalk for retailers prior to COVID, right? I think that's pretty well documented. And I'm curious to know, kind of, can you give us the lay of the land pre-COVID?
Sure, Stuart. And I think you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, it's not like retailers were enjoying salad days prior to this pandemic. First off, the U.S. has been overstored for quite some time. If you look at the number of stores per capita in the U.S. compared to a lot of other countries, it's much, much higher. And so we've seen continued consolidation in the retail industry, mostly in the form of bankruptcy. So just over the last decade or so, you've seen a number of firms go by the wayside, such as Linz and Things, Circuit City, Radio Shack, H.H. Gregg. The list goes on and on. And I think two future additions to that list are going to be JCPenney and Neiman Marcus. They both, within the last week, missed bond payments. So I think that they're going to end up eventually liquidating as well. We've also seen, and this has been part and parcel with the fact that the U.S. is overstored, this continued secular shift to online shopping. You're having more and more consumers buying products online. And quite frankly, in general, when they buy them online, they're not buying them from brick and mortar retailers. They're buying them from the Amazons of the world. Now, the U.S. penetration of e-commerce is still fairly low. It's about 11% of sales, although the effective penetration is higher because that includes a lot of product categories that'll probably never move online, like buying cars or buying gasoline. Now, what's interesting is even though you have this secular shift to online shopping, some of the pure e-commerce retailers are starting to realize the value of brick and mortar stores. So I'll give you one example, Amazon. Amazon for years was trying to really get into the grocery delivery business, really wasn't having much success, and realized, you know what, we're going to need a brick and mortar presence if we're really going to go after the grocery market. So they bought Whole Foods. Even Warby Parker, so the eyeglass retailer, they started out purely online in 2010, and they began opening stores in 2013. They now operate well over 100. And then the final thing, and once again, kind of related, is what does, you know, some brilliant consultant came up with the term omni-channel retailing. So basically what that means is that you have brick and mortar stores, but you also have an online presence. If you do it well, you kind of meld the two. So for example, consumers can buy things online, but pick them up in the stores. For example, Best Buy, 40% of their online orders are picked up at the store. Some retailers are shipping from their stores, so actually using their stores as distribution points. So those are some of the major trends that we saw pre-coronavirus.
It's interesting, you know, Insurance AM Journal is an omni-channel distributor as well. So just thought I'd put in a plug there. So it's been well documented, Anthony, that a lot of retailers have had to close their stores because of shelter-in-place orders. All non-essential stores are being shuttered. My wife owns a Pilates studio. She hasn't been able to go to work. They've converted to online, but it's a fraction of what they used to do in terms of sales. This is not our first rodeo in terms of recession. We think it's pretty clear that COVID is going to cause a recession. Not sure how deep, not sure how long, but we had the Great Recession. How do you see this as the same kind of thing? I mean, how retailers did then, or is it a different time and we're going to see something different this time?
Yeah, that's a great question, Stuart. So I really see sort of two stages to this, right? The stage we're in right now, shelter in place, and then the stage that's going to come after that when stores are going to be reopened, but we're still going to be in a pretty deep recession. Right now, as we're in this shelter in place mode, the retailers that are best positioned are obviously the ones who've been able to keep their stores open. The retailers have been deemed essential retailers. Of the 19 companies that I cover, I would say about 6 or 7 of them have been deemed essential retail, so they have been able to keep their stores open. So think of a company like Amazon, right? They're an online store, so they don't really have any issue with shelter in place. They also own Whole Foods, which is as a grocery retailer, has been able to keep open. I cover a company, Big Lots, that actually sells a lot of food and consumables. They've been able to keep open. Same thing with the dollar stores. Same thing with Tractor and Supply, which sells farming supplies. But the vast majority of their stores are closed right now, which is really, really tough. Now, at some point, and we don't know if that's going to be June 1st, July 1st, retailers will be able to open their stores, but we will be in a recession. And what we've seen in past recessions, particularly the Great Recession, is generally the retailers that do the best are retailers that sell non-discretionary items. So think food, consumables, health and beauty care items. You've got to eat even if there's a recession. So think grocery stores. In my coverage list, also the dollar stores, Dollar General, Dollar Tree. In addition to that, retailers that sell lower priced items, because basically what you see in a recession is that consumers are looking for ways to save money. Once again, you know, the dollar stores, you'll see consumers trade down from higher priced supermarkets, convenience stores, drug stores. I also cover a company, National Vision, which is sort of a extreme value optical retailer, which I think will do quite well in a recession. Conversely, retailers that sell more discretionary, higher ticket items. So think, for example, like a Williams Sonoma, a Restoration Hardware, they don't do so well in a recessionary environment.
So you mentioned Amazon. We've talked about Amazon before. They're one of the largest retailers. Everything seems to come from Amazon. What are the implications of Amazon's continued rise for regular retailers? And the other thing, and I mean, this is just anecdotal, but it seemed like when all this happened, Amazon's shipping capabilities and their logistics sort of got overwhelmed. I mean, things that used to show up in 2 days or 1 day suddenly took considerably longer. So it's not a panacea for Amazon, is it?
So I have a long and sort of complicated history with Amazon. Several years ago, I actually was not covering Amazon, and I wrote this report talking about the fact that Amazon plays on this sort of unlevel playing field. They don't collect state sales tax. Their investors are just focused on top line growth, not on profitability. And at some point, you know, the scales are going to sort of tip back towards these traditional retailers. Amazon's going to have to collect state sales tax. Amazon investors are going to demand that the company is profitable, so they're going to have to raise prices or pull back on services. I was dead wrong. I was literally
Don Quixote, like tilting at windmills. I finally got to a point because I sort of been informally covering for Amazon for so long where I just sort of said, if you can't beat them, join them. And so I've been covering Amazon now for the past couple of years, and I have a really great understanding of that company. The rise of Amazon has been very, very bad for a lot of retailers. I mean, some of those retailers that I mentioned that have gone out of business, it's been directly a result of Amazon. They're really good at what they do. Now, having said that, there are retailers that can coexist with Amazon. So, for example, retailers that sell items where there's an immediacy of need. So think about, you know, once again, like a supermarket or a drugstore. I mean, you can't wait a day or a couple of days, you know, to fill a prescription or to buy food that you're going to use to cook a meal that particular day. In addition to that, retailers that sell, you know, generally kind of like lower priced items where shipping is not economical, and retailers that sell, you know, sort of bulky items. So think, for example, I cover floor and decor, a hard surface flooring retailer. It just doesn't make sense. It's just not economical, you know, to ship those products online. And then there are some retailers, quite frankly, that are right Amazon's crosshairs, but they've evolved to be able to coexist with Amazon. I think the poster child, quite frankly, is Best Buy. 7-8 years ago, it was a foregone conclusion that Amazon was going to put Best Buy out of business, like they had put Circuit City out of business. But Best Buy got a new management team, including a CFO who had worked at Williams-Sonoma, so who was really good with omnichannel retailing, quite frankly, even before we were calling it omnichannel retailing, and they fought back. They dropped their prices, so they were pretty much at price parity with Amazon. They overhauled their website, so their capabilities were much more in line with Amazon. They started shipping from their store, so they could suddenly ship as fast, if not faster, than Amazon. And they made a lot of investments in their stores, including opening a bunch of shopping shops within their stores, many of them vendor-funded, so it was a much better experience within the store. So there's nothing to say that Amazon is going to completely take over, but you've got to either somewhat be insulated from them or compete better with them. In terms of your question about how Amazon is faring in this pandemic, I mean, Amazon's doing great. I mean, this is really kind of playing right into Amazon's wheelhouse. Now, they were overwhelmed with orders. And so one of the things that they had to do early on is that they had to say, okay, third-party retailers, so retailers who sell their products through Amazon, we're no longer going to accept your orders because we were just overwhelmed. And they also started to focus on more kind of essential products, so food items, safety type items. But it seems like some of that is actually starting to abate a bit. And quite frankly, from a long-term perspective, I think what's happened, particularly with social distancing, is there's a lot of consumers who really weren't shopping online, particularly like older people weren't really comfortable shopping online, that suddenly had to get comfortable. And I can almost guarantee you a lot of those people, they went to Amazon. So I think that this pandemic is actually going to help Amazon long term.
What about technology for other retailers? Obviously, technology is a big driver for Amazon, but anybody else?
So, you know, look, at a very high level, technology, and it's not just Amazon, but technology's really changed retail. For example, price transparency is higher than it's ever been. And the reason it's higher than it's ever been is we all carry smartphones. So you used to go into a store and you'd see a product that you wanted, let's say it was a television, and you saw the price, and you really couldn't tell, is that a good price? Is that a bad price? Now, you could certainly drive to a bunch of other stores to check that price, but not a lot of people typically did that. But now, if you have a smartphone, you can pull up that TV and you can instantly get the prices at 20 other retailers. And the problem, going back to Best Buy, the problem that Best Buy had was that consumers were going to their stores, seeing the TV, seeing the picture, getting the customer service. They were pulling out their smartphone and found out that Amazon had that same TV 20% cheaper. And so they were buying on Amazon. If they were really cold, they were doing it right in the store, right on their smartphone. So, you know, the days of being able to kind of fool consumers are over. In addition to that, even like the concept of the loss leader. So that was basically something where a retailer would sell a particular product at a really, really low price, a lot of times low cost, largely because they wanted the consumer to come in to pick up an item, but they would pick up a bunch of other items as well that were at full price. Those days, once again, are over because the consumer can easily go to that store, cherry pick that one item, see the other items are overpriced, and say, you know, I'm going to go and buy them somewhere else. So technology really, it really has changed the retail industry. And the retailers have really had to keep up from a technological perspective, particularly in terms of omnichannel, particularly their online businesses. And the tough thing there is that Amazon is constantly evolving their capabilities. So it's not like as a retailer, you can just spend a bunch of money on your e-commerce site and call it good, because Amazon's constantly evolving their capabilities. So you have to constantly play catch up. It's almost like a never-ending investment cycle.
Technology impacts so many industries in so many different ways. Okay, so final end of this thing. For equity investors out there, Anthony Chukwuma, buy, sell, or hold. Who do you like? Where are you cautious? What's the rundown?
Sure. So I'm going to give you two names that I'm pretty excited about, and one I'm more cautious on. And I mentioned this one company early in the podcast, National Vision. The ticker symbol is EYE. Basically, they are an extreme value optical retailer. So they sell eyeglasses primarily, as well as contact lenses. They've got a few different concepts, but the two primary ones are one that's called America's Best Contact Lenses and Eyeglasses, and the second one is called Eyeglass World. America's Best Contact Lenses and Eyeglasses, their opening price point offer is two pairs of glasses and an eye exam for $69.95. You heard me right, $69.95. That is much lower than your lens crafters, your Pearle Vision setters, Christ, even your Warby Parkers of the world. And one thing that I will say is actually the glasses I'm wearing right now, I got at America's Best. So just as good as any other pair of glasses that I've ever bought. And I'm almost embarrassed at the price that I paid at other times with other retailers.
I can attest how nice they look. I really can.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Stuart. So National Vision, so it's a great concept. The optical retailing market has great secular tailwinds. First off, the aging of the U.S. population. So as you get older, you need glasses, period. That's just the way that it goes. In addition to that, we're spending more and more time on these smartphones. The more time you're spending looking at screens, the worse your eyes are going to get. The eyeglass retailing market is incredibly fragmented. And National Vision, you know, in those two concepts that I mentioned, America's Best and Eyeglass World, they've got a lot of growth runway ahead of them. They have about, between the two of them, call about 860 stores. They think that the U.S. can support almost 1,900 stores. One major indicator for a retailer's health is comparable store sales. It's basically sales growth when you kind of strip out the new stores they've opened. National Vision has had positive comparable store sales growth for 72 straight quarters. 72. That's 18 years of positive comps. It's also an incredibly well-managed company. The CEO, Reed Fies, is just a complete stud. The other company that I really like right now is called Aarons, so ticker symbol AAN. So basically, it's a little bit of a complicated story, but they are one of the largest rent-to-own retailers in the U.S. So basically, it's for people who don't have the cash to buy, you know, a washer and dryer, let's say, a refrigerator, dining room set, and have a low FICO score, so they can't get a Visa or even a store-branded credit card. So with Aarons, you basically rent the merchandise, and if you make a certain number of payments over time, you own that merchandise. Now, this is, once again, a great business and a bad environment, because generally recessions, access to consumer credit completely dries up. And so you will have consumers who are trading down from sort of store-branded credit cards or some private credit cards to rent to own. The other thing that we're really excited about with Aarons is that they have this great business where they provide rent to own services in third-party retailers. So for example, they provide rent to own services in Best Buy, in Lowe's, in Conn's, in Signet, which owns Jared Jewelers. And that business is growing like a weed. They signed up two of their largest accounts ever last year, specifically Best Buy and Lowe's. So we should see multiple years of very high growth in that business just from the maturation of those two partners. One company we're very cautious on right now is At Home, ticker symbol HOME. So basically, think about a Pier 1 on steroids. The stores are about 110,000 square feet on average. So that's the size of a decently sized Walmart. They don't even sell furniture. It's all furnishings. So think about 100 linear feet of bar stools or wall art. There's no merchandising curation. It just really kind of overwhelms the senses, quite frankly. In addition to that, make matters worse, there's virtually no customer service whatsoever. One portfolio manager that I met with once, he basically said, you could die in an At Home and they wouldn't find your body for weeks. So it's just not a great concept, quite frankly. And they're very highly leveraged. This is a company that went through an LBO before they were public. They still have a lot of debt from that LBO. The stores are currently closed due to shelter in place regulations. So there's a decent chance these guys might not make it to the other side. And I use the word Pier 1 very deliberately because that's a company that just recently filed for bankruptcy and will likely liquidate. So that's one that I would avoid. At Home, ticker symbol HOME.
Man, that's fun. I mean, people I think often say that research analysts don't give you clear guidance. And Nothing's more clear than that. It's been fun, man. Appreciate you taking the time. You know, to be honest with you, if it wasn't for shelter in place, we probably wouldn't be able to bring such a, you know, a well-known analyst on. So thank you. And thanks for putting up with me as we go through this shelter in place order as well. So,
yeah, no, I appreciate you having me on. And I do want to tell one story before we go. I mean, one of the first times I really got to know Stuart, we live in Chicago. We live next door to each other, as Stuart mentioned. And as anybody who's lived in the Midwest knows, it snows here a lot, a lot. And so every morning last winter, it seemed like literally 2-3 days a week, it would snow. And so before I went to work, and I get up really early to take the train downtown to get to my office and work, I'd have to shovel the snow. And I would do this every day. I'd get up, I'd shovel the snow, and I'd walk to the train, and I'd get on the train. So one day, I get a text message from my neighbor, who's hosting this podcast, saying, hey, we got to figure something out, man. Like, when you get up real early and shovel the snow, it wakes my wife up. My wife's giving me a hard time. Like, what are we going to do? And so then so I tell my wife, and my wife's like yelling at me, like, what's with this guy? Like, you know, you need to shovel that snow. Like, we need to be able to walk around, yada, yada, yada. So we got it all figured out. So it was all good. But that was my introduction to the Stuart Foley experience.
And that 4:30 in the morning snow shoveling, I was like, holy cow. But it worked out well, right? We've got a chance to know each other. That's and right. Become friends. So it's good. Listen, thanks so much, Anthony Chikumba. Thanks for having us part of your day here, man. We appreciate you. Thanks for listening. This is Stuart Foley with Insurance AUM Journal Podcast.